Sick of procurement bottlenecks? Get the cure with Bill Procurement. Bill is the all-in-one platform trusted by nearly 500,000 businesses to simplify their financial operations. And now they've introduced Bill Procurement, which pairs seamlessly with accounts payable to automate procure-to-pay workflows in one place. Every step, from submitting a purchase request to reconciling payment, happens in Bill Procurement, so your business keeps moving and growing. Score $200 when you see Bill Procurement in action with a demo. Go to bill.com/procurement200. bill.com/procurement200.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to tune in. I definitely do appreciate you being here. And as always, feel free to join us over in the Discord room. There's a link to that off of the Beekeeping for Newbies. That's newbees.com homepage. And I hope that you're having a great day today and that you don't have a headache anywhere near as bad as I do. Today's warm-up song is going to be Friends in Low Places by Garth Brooks. This is a song that I don't even remember hearing this until a buddy of mine played it. I don't know if it was like a jukebox or something like that at a Holiday Inn on Gordon Boulevard in Augusta, Georgia in the summer of 1993 when we were there for our advanced training. There was this song and a couple other ones. I can't remember what the other ones were that we used to play all the time back then. But anyway, that's the warm-up song of the day. So today's going to be episode 172, B-Buzz 28. For those of you who may not be familiar with some of the numbering conventions, I used to do, you know, like episode 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then I did, you know, B-Buzz episode 1, and then I might have, like, Bees in the News episode 1, and then you ended up having these three separate naming conventions going through the whole list of podcasts, and it kind of became a little bit confusing, at least I thought that it could be. So what I started doing is just, everything is just an episode in sequential numerical order. And then you'll see B-Buzz with the 28 in parentheses afterwards being the 28th B-Buzz episode. So the B-Buzz is strictly Q&A. It's a culmination and a compiled list that comes from questions in the Discord room, emails. If I happen to bump into somebody every now and then, I'm out and about talking to someone and I get a question about bees, I'll include those in here as well. So that's what we're going to cover today. And there's a couple other things I'm working on as well. I think I mentioned to you guys about the upcoming big project we have going on. I'm putting together my shopping list for that. We're going to start ordering some things. I have a cool kind of like an informal sponsor that I'm going to mention to you guys coming up very soon. Kind of a little bit of a deal we've worked out, that which is really, it's a generous and pretty cool, exceptional kind of thing that I'm going to be excited to share with you here shortly. So that'll be coming up here in the next couple of weeks. I'm also going to be revamping the Bees in the News a little bit. What I was doing before was just going out and trying to find a couple of articles I thought were kind of cool and that I might want to share with everybody. What I'm going to do now, though, is I'm going to find articles that are specifically applicable to the beekeeping space, if possible, or something that's just completely off the wall, or something that has some kind of underlying messaging with it. Like when we talk about some of the stories we've had in the past where people have been, you know, Africanized bees have killed people cutting the grass or things like that are going on, you know, as an opportunity to reiterate the importance of safety and all these other things. So we're going to try to revamp a few things and you know, try to be a little more creative in the wintertime. This time of year for the Northern Hemisphere folks, you know, it really winds down right around 1st of July. The Discord room goes from, if you were to quantify the message traffic and the exchanges on a scale of like 1 to 100, it's like a 90. 95 in like April and May, and you hit July and it goes down to like 20. And then at this time of year, it's down to like 5 or 10. It's just the cyclical nature of beekeeping and the seasonal aspect of it. And it's just the way it is and it happens. But I'm trying to kind of find things to help people out who were in the off season, who thought about in, you know, August or September, like, hey, I might want to start keeping bees next year. You can kind of start ramping up now and you'll have a kind of a 6-month lead on the spring stuff that's going on, the education and things you have to learn for all the hands-on. Maybe you can kind of focus on the cognitive for now and work on the psychomotor stuff later on. All right, so we're going to jump in. I just posted a little message the other day and said, hey, we're doing a bee buzz if anybody has any questions. So we're going to start with those. Okay, the first one we have here is, we have to modify the table our bees are on. It's too tall and we have terrible leverage for picking up a heavy, deep brood box. When should we move for maintenance? We thought that they're less active or angry, you know, at certain times is what they're getting at here. Would it be better to move them at a time when they're not as active maybe in the winter time or once they've clustered, you know, for the season or for a cold spell. They really just didn't want to do something that was disruptive to the colony. So I would not say that there's a restriction on when you should or should not do anything. Remember, you're not moving the hive from one location to another. You're not, you know, trying to get them to do a specific activity or task like drawing out comb or storing sugar syrup. You're not talking about a specific feeding related issue. You're just talking about, I want to take them from where they are and put them on something that's a little bit lower. Now, the best case scenario would be, you know, where you have some kind of a tractor or whatever that you can just close the entrance up, go up to them, put a few straps around, lift it up, move the old table out of the way, put a lower one down, set them back down. That's perfect. Nice little garden tractor can handle that. Not everybody has those just sitting around, so I completely understand. You're probably going to need to take it apart and maybe do it by pieces. So the best way to do this, in my opinion, is I think you have kind of one of two options. You could go with the approach of let's wait until it's just cold. You know, when it's below 50 degrees, they're not really flying. And then ideally, you probably have three people. So one person on each side, you lift up, and then you have the other person pulls out the old table or support system or platform, set the new one down, and then set this on top and walk away, open the entrance back up and let them do their thing. That could be done really at any time of year. If you're in a position where you don't have the resources for that and you're going to have to do it solo, then pick a regular day where the temperatures are normal, you know, above 50 Fahrenheit. What is that, like 13 or 14, I guess, 12, 13, 14 Celsius. Then just go ahead and just do a disassembly. Take off the top, you know, outer cover, inner cover, one hive body, set it down on top of. What I always do is I take my like telescoping outer cover, flip it upside down, set it down, and then I take my first hive body, turn it 90 degrees, you know, horizontally, and set it down on top of that. And then every time I remove a hive body or piece, I just turn it 90 degrees and set it back on top of that telescoping outer cover that I've been using as sort of like just to keep things off of the ground. That works really well. So let's say you had, you know, a full stack bottom board, double deeps, queen excluder, you know, a medium or two, inner cover, outer cover, full kind of suite, just reverse order, right? Telescoping cover goes down. First hive body, 90 degrees, set that down. Next hive body, turn it 90 degrees, set it down. You know, pull the queen excluder off, set it to the side, whatever you want to do. Probably won't even put it back on for the rest of the season anyway. And just take everything apart all the way down to the bottom board. Bees are going to be flying around. They may not be super happy. They may be foragers, might be returning and landing in that area, very confused. Just go on about your way, put the lower table in, rebuild everything back. What I like to do, and it's not a big deal at all, but I do like to put some kind of a marker, whether it's on the ground or nearby or something that just says, this is the center point directly above this marker, left, right, you know, X, Y, and Z axis. This is where the entrance was, so that when I put everything back together, I'm aligning the entrance as close to where it originally was as possible. Again, if you're off 4 or 6 inches or whatever, they're going to figure it out. Don't worry about it. That's just something that I kind of like to do. The only thing we've talked about before, you know, how they propolize everything shut and then you kind of break that propolis seal. You know, it's getting cooler and the propolis is not as pliable as it once was. So there may potentially be a couple of little gaps and things. I wouldn't get too worried or bent out of shape about that. As long as they're still active and they have active days inside the hive, they'll go back through and patch anything up. So don't lose any sleep over that. The next question, what are moisture boards and should we use them? When should we use them? I'm sorry, I copied and pasted here. I did not pre-read here. So a moisture board is something that I have never owned, operated, used. So I had to reach out to the Manlake website to kind of get some information on that. Our moisture board helps protect your hives from moisture buildup during the winter months. It absorbs condensation and keeps your bees dry using materials designed to wick moisture inside the hive. Winter moisture board for beehive. Ensure the safety and well-being of your bees with a winter moisture board from Manlake. Excess moisture in the hive can lead to freezing or drowning. So I'll pause right there. The issue is not particularly with moisture in the hive. It is excessive moisture in the hive. I have had some in my early years before I had my all-season inner cover. I would open up the outer cover. It would be like moldy and wet and gross. And then I would take the inner cover, a normal inner cover. I don't know what it weighs. Let's just say it's 2 pounds. My inner covers were like 6 pounds. They were completely saturated with water. It was absolutely terrible. And like I said, when I switched over to that all-season inner cover and have that about two-inch piece of foam insulation that sits in the middle, it's perfect. It provides a great amount of insulation. It keeps the condensation lower in the hive, reduces the risk to the bees. Now, the risk is not of an actual freezing risk. And I think that, I mean, the folks at Man Lake are pretty smart. They've got some pretty bright people over there. I just don't like the wording because it says that excess moisture in the hive can lead to freezing or drowning. I don't see a scenario where the bees are going to drown. I mean, I'm not even really going to go into that. I just don't see how that's possible at all. I think it can create a scenario where excess condensation can drip on them and cause them to not be able to thermoregulate, thereby resulting in a reduced temperature inside and around the cluster. When I say around the cluster, I mean like the edge bees on the mantle, like we discussed in the last episode. The tough part about this as a product, as a solution, as you know, whether or not you should spend $15.95 to buy one, the question is, well, how much moisture do you typically have in your hive already? Like, are you in the South where it's just god-awful humid kind of all the time? Or are you in a desert or a high desert or an area where it's just a much drier climate? That's kind of a big question. Even in the South, I still think, once again, I made a different change, but I made a change that I found to be really effective, not using a moisture board. So I don't know that I would tell anybody like, hey, you got to run out and get one of these. I don't think it's necessarily going to hurt. It looks like it's about an inch thick. So if nothing else, it's going to have some insulative properties to it. I think it would be one of those things where it would be certainly worth experimenting. If I had like 10 or 15 people, you know, reaching out like, oh my God, Jeff, this sounds so amazing, but I don't really know if it's worth the investment. I mean, I can buy one and throw it on a hive next year and we'll see how it works. But I mean, I'm not going to rush out to get one. So that's kind of my opinion on that one. There's a lot of stuff out there that is advertised at, you know, through companies that make money selling bee things, and they're not always necessarily things that you need to get. So if you have the extra money, you want to try it out, I don't think it's going to hurt at all. There's nothing bad's going to happen with it. If you do put it on, I definitely recommend having it directly above that last hive body. So if it truly is wicking moisture away, you want that full surface area to have exposure to the hive portion of your hardware, not just above the inner cover, if that makes sense. Okay, next question. Should I reduce my hive from 2 brood boxes down to 1 before winter? Now, we're going to talk about something that is going to apply to multiple questions. I skimmed the list. A lot of times I try to just copy-paste just so I don't get, well, two problems I have. One of them is I'll start answering them as I go when I'm reading them, and I'll spend like 2 hours just going through them ahead of time, being like, oh, that's pretty cool. And then I get sidetracked and the whole ADD thing. So I try not to look at them too much. I do know there are other discussions and other questions that are going to come up that we're going to talk about with, you know, what should I do here? How much this, how much that? And a lot of these all come back down to you, your solution as a beekeeper, your individual setup. These things are very, unfortunately, very individual and unique because of the fact that there's so many different hardware configurations that you could be deploying in your apiary. So as an example, I talked to a gal by email the other day called Hive Hugger. She has a solution that essentially, and we're going to have these in video here shortly. I'm going to show you how these work, how to set them up. I'll walk you through everything as soon as I get them. But it's basically a insulation solution to wrap around, you know, the tops and sides of the beehive. And it's designed for your stock hardware. If you have Langstroth 8-frame, 10-frame, if you have Nukes, you know, whatever solution you have that's kind of a mainstream solution, they've got an answer for it. And I'm pretty sure if you had something custom and had enough, you know, enough people or enough interest in it, I'm sure they could probably figure something out to make something custom. Can't commit to that or guarantee it. Anyway, if you're using something like that, and then you're comparing that to a traditional Langstroth hive that's, you know, 5/8, 3/4 of an inch thick, you're talking about two completely different needs and overwintering requirements. So going back to the question, should I reduce my hive from 2 brood boxes down to 1 before winter? You definitely can. I mean, for example, I've had many colonies over the years that have had double brood boxes. They start at the bottom, or maybe I even reversed them sometimes going into the spring, but they'll be at the bottom raising brood. They'll go up top and start, you know, put a little bit more brood up there and surround it with honey. They'll go up even higher and have one or two mediums full of honey. And then they never actually make it all the way back down to the bottom deep. So I'll have a deep that's got some winter bees still developing and some brood and some pollen and some bee bread and a couple frames of honey there and maybe one or two supers of honey above that. If that bottom deep is not being used at all, when I say not being used, I mean you don't have a ton of resources in there that are going to be crucial for either getting through the winter or raising new brood in the early spring, you can absolutely take that off, right? You don't want to have anything there that's just excess space to heat. If it doesn't have value to the hive and the colony's long-term survival for the winter, feel free to take it off. Just make sure that you're cognizant of how important it is for them to have space in the spring for that rapid expansion. So don't forget about that. Eating healthy can feel like a chore sometimes, right? But I've found something that makes it easy and delicious. Washington Red Raspberries. These aren't just any frozen berries. They're grown by family farmers in Washington State, picked at peak ripeness and frozen within hours to lock in nutrients. We're talking fiber, antioxidants, vitamin C, real nutrition with no added sugar, just fruit as nature intended. I toss them into smoothies, stir them into yogurt, and even top my oatmeal with them. They're so fresh and full of flavor, I actually look forward to eating healthier. And honestly, it feels so good knowing I'm supporting American family farms every time I grab a bag, and you'll know they're grown right here in the U.S. because it says so on the package. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at Costco, Kroger, Meijer, and Winco Foods. Look for them in Kirkland's Three Berry Blend, Smucker's Raspberry Jam, Peanut Butter and Raspberry Uncrustables, or those True Fruit chocolate-covered raspberries I can't stop snacking on. Want recipes, tips, or to see all the places you can find them? Go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. Do I need a queen excluder going into the winter? I have had this discussion a few times before. I have done the configuration where it's a double deep queen excluder and a medium, and I've just left that on. I just have left it like that. The medium stays behind for them for emergency in case there's not enough resources between the two, the double deeps. If there's not enough in there and they need to go up to get more, they can do that. People have said never leave queen excluders on because you don't want the cluster to go ahead and leave the queen behind. And I haven't tested it. I haven't experimented with it, so I can't say definitively. I can tell you that I have left the queen excluder on numerous times, but only one medium above it. I haven't done it where it's like a single deep with a queen excluder and like three mediums. That scenario I have not attempted. That would definitely concern me. But I have done many years of double deeps, queen excluder, and a medium, and had no problems at all with the colony surviving and consuming resources and everything. As a rule, what I would say, just take it off. And the reason I say to take it off is I don't want anything within the colony to have a restriction in the wintertime. If I don't want them to have to stop and think like, well, wait a minute, we're here for the queen and we got to take care of her, but we really need to go get some resources. I don't want the dilemma. If she wants to go up there and decides that she's going to lay some eggs in a honey super in the spring, then lay some eggs in the honey super in the spring. Because here's the thing. If you restrict them to only laying down in those brood boxes and they're trying to ramp up in the spring, now they're going up to get the feeds and they're coming back down to protect the brood and they're going up to get the feed and they're coming down to get the brood. They've got to raise that brood. And if they're clustered all together where their resources are, they can stay warm, feed the brood, protect the brood, and continue raising new brood even on those cooler late winter, early spring nights. So my recommendation, if I had to tell you one way or another, I would say just get rid of the queen excluder. It makes it easy across the board to just simply get rid of it. How small should I make the entrance reducer to keep mice and cold winds out? From a wind standpoint, I definitely recommend, and again, I'm talking to kind of like the North America thing where we are in the prevailing westerlies. I recommend, facing your bees maybe to like the southeast, the east, maybe the northeast. Not having those entrances facing directly to the west, or particularly the northwest, where some of those cooler winds are coming from. As it relates to mice and things, a mouse does not need very much space at all to squeeze through and get into a hive. So I recommend bringing the entrance down to, like if you're using an entrance reducer, like a commercial one, I would bring that down to the smallest ones, usually about 3/4 of an inch or an inch. I think by studies and research, they'll tell you that bees prefer an entrance to be around 1 1/4 inches is what they prefer. So you can certainly make a custom one that brings it down to 1 1/4 inches, whatever you want to do. But definitely, you really don't need anything more than about an inch, just enough room for them to get in and out, let a little bit of cool air in, and you should be fine. But again, you're going to want to put some hardware cloth, like some number two hardware cloth, or, you know, something over the entrance to prevent those, four-legged critters from trying to get in. Should I add an upper entrance or ventilation hole to help with condensation? This answer is no. The more and more research I read and the more that I see, bees do not want a upper entrance. That upper entrance is going to contribute to excessive condensation. All that cold air is going to slam into that hot air. And that's when you start getting the moisture and the condensation forming above the cluster, dripping down onto the cluster. Bees prefer a single entrance in the lower one-third of the hive. So that's what I would be aiming for. Is a screened bottom board okay for winter, or should I close it up? So this is really funny. If you would ask me like a year or two ago, I would say you absolutely have to close up your screened bottom boards, either replace it with a solid bottom board, or just like you slide a sticky board or an IPM board underneath and those rails that many of them have, you just need to slide like a thin, maybe like a 3/64 or a 1/4 inch piece of board that can slide in there just to protect it from direct air moving up and down. I would have said, like, you had to do that or the bees are going to get too cold. A couple years ago, I completely forgot. I had one colony that I completely forgot to slide that in, and they had a screened bottom board all winter. And it was a regular cold winter. I mean, it wasn't excessively or unusually cold, but it was still a regular cool winter, and they had no issues and kept going the next year, and everything was fine. So don't be like me. Definitely put something there. Either switch back to the solid bottom board, or just put an IPM board in there, or just put something to obstruct a lot of that direct airflow from coming in. All right, we're going to go into a food and feeding category here. How much honey does a colony need to survive the winter in my region? That is going to depend. That's very similar, I think, to what we talked about, you know, a little bit earlier about how many brood boxes and all of that. We used to kind of try to say, I shouldn't say we, I guess I used to really try to give you sort of a, if you are here, then this is probably what you need scenario. And I think a lot of times I probably didn't do a really good job of explaining and articulating the importance of recognizing the type of hardware that you're using and just how important that is. And I think that because I'm in an area that does, you just don't have to, like, I don't have to have heavy duty insulation and all these different things to allow my bees to be successful. However, because I'm going to be rolling some of these things out over the next couple of years and monitoring them and testing and evaluating and providing all the numbers and the feedback, I think what we're going to find is I have really good overwinter success rates anyway, but I think what I'm going to be able to do is I'll be able to do more splits even later. I'm going to have much smaller colonies that I can overwinter without having to have a ton of resources, which then this allows me to have a stronger spring with more bees available for making cell builders and other things. So it's not a matter of can they survive with basic hardware here or there. It's a matter of what can you do to maximize, you know, your ability to maintain and expand your apiary, leveraging and using the minimal amount of resources from the bees that they have to use. So that's a really long way of basically saying we can't really just say, if you're here or below, it's 50 pounds. Once you get above this latitude, it's going to be 80 pounds or 100 pounds. If you're using traditional regular hardware, there are a lot of people that can kind of give you roughly what that looks like within your area. So I can give you like a really generic thing, probably like in the south, you know, and I say in the south, I'm talking about like probably not the mountainous areas, but like the flatter and coastal areas of North Carolina and south, you know, all the way across the country. Well, not all the way across the country because the desert's a different animal. But in the southeast, you can pretty much, you know, probably get away with just, you know, a much lower amount because let's say you did 30 or 40 pounds. I don't even know, maybe 30 pounds. That might be fine, but they're going to be more active too, right? A lot of the challenges we have is the bees become active on warmer days. And as they start flying and becoming active, that starts to diminish their overall lifespan, which reduces the size of the cluster, which will impact their ability to overwinter in that later part of the season when they need the bigger cluster. So that's kind of a different dynamic to it. If you were to just say state by state, like, well, once you get to, let's say, Virginia, Maryland, you maybe add like 5 or 10 pounds. Then you start getting up into like Pennsylvania, maybe like another 20 pounds. And then you get into New York and Massachusetts. So by the time you get up to like Maine, you're probably 90 or 100 pounds, something like that. Again, that's really, really super generic, not specific, and probably not all that helpful. So I'm still going to default back to what I tell you is, you know, if you can find a local bee club or someone in your area who can provide some guidance as to what they've done and what they've experienced, I still think that's going to be really the best approach. Now, if you are really in a bind and you're really hung up on this, shoot me an email, give me your zip code, and I'll do a little bit of research and see, you know, what I can come up with based on your area, what your average temperatures are, and tell me what your hardware is. And if you say, hey, I got a double deep, I'm all 8-frame hardware, I've got this extra stuff on hand, here's what everything looks like today, what do you think? I'll give you my 2 cents. All right, so next we have, should I leave sugar syrup on, or is it too late once it gets cold? The biggest issue you have with sugar syrup is the bees will actually not take it up. They're not going to start bringing in more nectar if they are not going to be able to get it adequately cured and the moisture removed from it for them to be able to cap it and store it long term. So you'll hit that threshold when the outside temperature typically is right around that like 55, 58 degrees Fahrenheit, so probably like 14, 15, you know, Celsius. In that range, they're probably going to stop taking it up. What you want to do is you just don't want to be in a situation where you've left it in there and then it gets really cold and you want to go get it out. Now you've got to open up the hive and expose them to the cold, you know, to get your, you know, to recover your sugar syrup feeder. But that's again where I recommend, if you're doing late season feeding, if you can get it up and out, like if you have a outer cover that has a hole that you can just drop your feeder into, great. You can just pull the feeder and like a jar feeder, you can just pull the jar, cover it up and you're done. If you're using a top feeder, no problem, right? Take off your outer cover, inner cover, pull the feeder off, drop your inner cover back on, outer cover, and you're fine. I would just really recommend, like if you've got, let's say, a double deep configuration with a medium or two on top of that, and you're using a frame feeder, don't have it all the way down in the very bottom. You don't want to have to break everything down, one, to refill the feeder, and two, to be able to recover it at the end of the season. Now, you don't have to take it out. You could just say, look, I'm just going to leave the feeder here. I know I'm going to use it in the spring. That's cool. Nothing wrong with that. Remember two things. Make sure you get syrup in there early in the season or get it out, because they will start trying to draw comb around it and propolize it in place. You may want to remove it once or twice to make sure it's not completely stuck in there, because they will make everything a part of the hive forever if you allow them to do that. So make sure you're getting it out or at least moving it. But if you do take it out, just go ahead and, you know, backfill it with, ideally with honey or at least a blank foundation. Put something in the space versus just leaving that space empty. And as an alternative to, you could switch to open feeding. The only downside, again, to open feeding is you're feeding your bees, you know, plus everybody else in your area. But if there aren't a lot of bees in your area, that's really not going to be an issue. All right, next up, do I need to add sugar bricks, fondant, or candy boards? So if you talk to somebody who sells sugar bricks, fondant, and candy boards, you absolutely need to get these things. Colonies can't survive without sugar bricks, fondant, or candy boards. That's what they're probably going to tell you. And I've told the story God knows how many times, and I'm just going to keep saying it because I think it's important. I was reading my first year, doing all the research. They were like, you got to put something in there over the winter. And I had all these options, and I'm like, all right, I found fondant. I'll put that in. Didn't touch it the first year. Like, they literally didn't touch it. I think they died too. I can't remember. But they didn't touch it. Second year, I had leftover, put another big brick of fondant in, and I think they did consume about half of it. I don't remember. I just don't think it had a huge impact, though. I think that they still have plenty of resources, and then they gnawed on the fondant a little bit. My goal is always to feed my bees at a time when they can pack everything away into frames, whether it's natural honey that they've acquired through nectar in the environment, or whether it's sugar honey that they've stored away. I don't care, but I want it to be in the frames with everything else. That's going to be the best thing. Yes, they can go up and they can salivate onto some of these sugary things and liquefy things a little bit, or with some condensation, liquefy it enough to lick a little bit of some kind of energy off of it. But I just think that the focus, if your mindset is, here's my strategy every year, I'm going to take all of their honey, feed them sugar as long as I can, and then throw a bunch of these bricks and fondants and things in there, and that's going to be the solution. I don't agree with that approach. I don't think that's the right way to do it. I don't think it's the best thing for the bees. And I just don't know that those are preferred things that they want to consume. Like I someday I will break down and I will abuse one or more of my colonies by putting these things in there. But like granulated sugar is the one, you guys have heard me rant about that one forever. So my answer is no, you don't need any of these things. These things are not necessary. Feed your bees, allow your bees to gather as much as they can through the season. Supplemental feed them going into the fall, winter, so they can ramp up the winter production of bees, and store away some additional syrup, and then see how much you have left over in the spring. That's my recommendation. How can I tell if my bees are starving during the winter? This is a big driver behind the project that I'm working on that I'm going to go into great detail on in one of the next episodes here, probably next Monday, I think. But when you're on the outside, and it's wintertime, the bees aren't going to come out. Now, people will tell you different things like, oh, you can go up to the hive and just kind of tap on it a little bit and, or just kind of give it a little bit of a shake and they'll start buzzing. You go, oh, they're still alive. You can still get kind of like a heartbeat check to know that they're still there. But how do you truly know if they are starving? Now, a lot of people will open their hives on a 40 or 50 Fahrenheit day in the wintertime and look inside. I generally don't do that. The rule I've kind of settled on for me is I don't look until the first warm day in February. If a bee colony that I have can't make it through, October, November, December, and January, if they can't make it that far, they definitely don't have the right genetics. If we get to February, that's where there are some environmental factors that can be at play that can make things even difficult for your best genetics, the colonies with the best genetics. So I will look on a warm day, but what I'm looking for is to see how high up that they are in the hive. If they've worked their way all the way up to the top and it's like February 15th, you probably need to drop some pollen patties and start figuring things out because they're probably running out of resources. Now, the project that I'm working on, what we're going to be able to do is have temperature sensors all through the hive, and then we're going to be able to real-time track. I'm going to actually have it auto-populate this data to my website. You'll be able to go in and look at hive number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever, and see like real-time data, like last posted 15 minutes ago or whatever it is. You can look at a historical playback and play a video of the hive's cluster's temperature over the past 24 hours and see how the cluster moves. But with the multiple numerous sensors that'll be there, you'll be able to see, okay, well, this is a heat map of where the cluster is. And I will know. I will know where all of them are. If I see the temperature, the core temperature and that mantle temperature, if I see these temperatures dropping significantly, I'm going to know, okay, well, I've got, as an example, the first round of testing has five hives. Well, I've got four of them that are sitting there at, 83, 85 degrees and one that's at 76, 72. Like that one might be a concern. Three of them are near the middle working sideways. One of them is all the way at the top, that kind of thing. I will know just by looking at my heat maps and the individual hives, temperature footprint, I'll know exactly where they are and how much they have left. But for a regular everyday person, the only option you have is to take a position. You can say, every time there's a nice day, I'm going to open the hive and I'm going to look in. I don't care. That's what I'm going to do. You can absolutely do that. You can add supplemental feeds like we've discussed in the last question. If you want to add those at any time during the season and put them on life support and hope that that works, you can absolutely do that. I do recommend that you try to be as quick as you possibly can, because allowing all of that cold air to come in there, it's not going to kill the bees. They're in a cluster. They're going to move around. Just be fast about it. Be quick and get in, get out, and get back to let them get back to their work. When should I stop feeding liquid syrup in the fall? Again, I think we kind of covered that on the last one when we talked about some of the feeders and things. But again, it's kind of when they stop taking it up, which is going to be somewhere in that high 50s mark, by sub 60, mid 50s, somewhere in that range is when they're probably going to stop taking it up. Just make sure you're not leaving it in the hive for extended periods. Put the syrup on 3, 4, 5 days. If they haven't consumed it, go ahead and take it out and be done with it. Well, everybody, I'm only halfway through the questions, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to wrap up this edition of the Bee Buzz. We're going to go ahead and get this published right away. I'll have my other episode that I discussed for you on Monday about the hive monitoring. I'm going to discuss the problem that we're trying to solve, why it's an issue, walk through all the details, the pieces and the parts and components. I'm not going to go into as great a depth on the podcast as I will in a supplemental video, but the video is going to have all the details. So if you want to follow along at home and you want to build the project with me, and use these in your hives or experiment with them in your garage at the same time, all of that's going to be covered on Monday's episode. And then what we'll do is we'll post the follow-on, the second half to this Bee Buzz, which is going to be then Bee Buzz 29. We'll get that posted to release like about 8 days from now, next Thursday. And we'll just keep on trucking from there. So again, special thanks to all the Buy Me a Coffee supporters out there. I can't do any of this at all without your support. So thank you guys very, very much for everything. Check out bestbeekeepinggear.com. We got some articles there around Varroa mites and different treatment methods, some of the viruses and things that are carried by the mites, as well as some information on, you know, like top 10 initial beekeeping gear kinds of things, just miscellaneous things that are on that site. And we're going to keep updating that over time. Beekeepingfornewbies.com. It's N-E-W-B-E-E-S. That's all I got for you today, folks. Take care. Be kind to one another. Remember that I love you. There's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.